Clandest time.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Clandestine. I am your host, Tom Secker, coming to you from the grassy knolls of North Yorkshire, and this is episode 44, Homeland, Season 4.
It's not like when we were fighting the Cold War. Now the Russians were tough, but...
They didn't saw our heads off on the internet. Blow up innocent people. Fly airplanes into the Twin Towers.
Come on, Saul.
What?
We both know 9/11 was a hoax. An Israeli-American excuse to launch a crusade against the Muslim world.
Honestly, I don't know what to say when I hear men of your deep knowledge and experience talk like that.
President Bush lied about Iraq. Why not 9/11?
Because it's nonsense.
Oh.
Like saying bin Laden's not dead. Abbottabad was a CIA plot meant to embarrass Pakistan.
Once more, my good friend Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Radio joined me to discuss the latest series of Homeland, the CIA's pet TV project. We looked at how the show has been rebooted in this season, with a much more aggressive and ambitious purpose, both in mythologizing past events and predicting future ones. From 9/11 to the ISIS beheadings, to drone strikes to the Lone Gladio, this is a typically wide-ranging conversation on one of the most important shows currently on TV. Well, hello, Pierce. Welcome back to Clandestine. It's great to be talking to you again. And how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Tom. And it's always a pleasure to be on your show. And I have been looking forward to recording this podcast for many, many weeks now. So I'm really excited to finally talk about Homeland with you on your show.
Yeah, sure. We are, of course, going to be talking about the fourth season of the show Homeland. And we did do a show on the first three seasons. I think we covered all three of the seasons earlier in this year. And I suppose before we get into the actual season itself, I just wanted to establish once again, for the record, that this is, you know, the CIA's premier TV show, their kind of pet project on TV at the moment. Because we did cover this when we talked about this back in episode 16, which was actually in January of this year. Seems...
yeah, right?
I suppose that's in some ways, it seems like much longer than that. But anyway,
yes.
I just wanted to kind of hammer the point home on this front. I don't think people who watch the show will necessarily need much convincing that this is a CIA project, but... just for example, I have come across an interview with Alex Ganser, one of the main producers of the show, who talked about having this range of consultants, both retired people and people still working for the CIA, who, you know, they consulted while writing the show. There was also that recent Daily Beast article, which was titled CIA Agents Assess How Real is Homeland. And one of the two CIA agents who wrote the article was actually a consultant on the show, so he was effectively praising his own work. He's, you know, writing this piece about, you know, oh yes, the show is very realistic because, you know, I did my consulting job so well. And the CIA, I thought this was really funny, the CIA even included their usual disclaimer statement at the bottom of the article about how this, you know, wasn't official government opinion or whatever. But the last piece of evidence I wanted to draw people's attention to is possibly the most ludicrous cross-promotion I've ever come across. It was this event that was co-sponsored by Showtime, the people who make Homeland, Sheraton Hotels, and the CIA. And what happened was, a 30-year veteran of the CIA, who was, of course, a blonde woman, not at all unlike Carrie, the main character on Homeland, and... the hotel hosted an event presented by Nazanin Bonyadi, the actress who plays Farah in the show. And the event was called Spies Among Us. You can look this up on YouTube. You can see some clips from this. Basically, they got a room of guests, and they had to talk to these three blonde women and guess which one of them was the real spy, the real CIA agent. So they sort of mingled with them for a while, and then they, you know, ticked off which one of the three on a, you know, on a card or something, and they put them all into a box and counted them up and blah, blah, blah. And then they have the reveal, which one of them is actually the CIA agent, and it's this woman called Carol Rolly Flynn. And then the actress who plays Farah then interviews her and hosts this Q&A with the guests who are all playing along with the game.
Wow.
Seriously, this is one of the strangest, you know, like I say, the weirdest cross promotion I think I've ever seen in my life. I can't quite get. I don't see who dreamt this up. I mean, did you have anything you wanted to add to that list of evidence or just anything you wanted to say about
that? I suppose, I mean, I'm assuming that this blonde CIA agent is the same one who did these little spots and promos for Showtime where. You know, she was interviewed about how realistic the show was, and
yeah.
You know, yeah, so I mean, there we go again. And I guess just to kind of hammer that point, I don't even think the CIA is attempting to deny this anymore. I mean, from that thing you just talked about, that little event, to I mean, the fact that the show has, you know, premiered at Langley. And you know, and of course, in light of the Bo Bergdahl release, I mean, you know, how many obvious references were being made back and forth to, you know, the fact that the Homeland sort of, you know, predicted this or sort of colored our opinion on that whole saga. So, yeah, I mean, I think the CIA really is at this point firmly in control of the storyline. And, you know, this season, as I'm sure we'll get into, I mean, is very much a CIA production from start to finish.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But having put all that out there, and naturally there's going to be links to this stuff in the show notes, I think we should move on to the season itself. Coming off the back of our last conversation about Homeland, we were both not exactly looking forward to this season. We were thinking the show didn't really have anywhere left to go. They'd sort of strung out that whole Brody storyline about at least a season longer than it needed to be. And it did seem a bit like they were running out of ideas, which, to my mind, makes it fortunate, we should say, for them, that they had all these CIA consultants ready to feed them some fresh ideas for the show. And that very much, like you just alluded to, that very, very much seems to be what's happened with this season, is that they didn't know what to do with it, so they went and asked the CIA what they thought might make for interesting material, and they said, oh, well, you know, thanks for asking. But I think it's also fair to say, from our emails back and forth in the last few weeks and months while we've been watching this season play out, we've been totally turned around. We are now...
I am a firm supporter of Homeland now, as this season was, I mean, phenomenally better than... certainly better than the last season, which was just awful. But even the first season, which is actually quite entertaining, I think this one was way, way better. I mean, just head and shoulders above all of that. And it was actually, you know, there were some really compelling episodes. So, yeah, I am much, I guess, sort of happy that the CIA was sort of feeding them ideas, because it really made for a much more entertaining show.
Well, and a much more interesting show to discuss as well, which is, of course, why we've chosen it to talk about. I mean, I don't even find this show to be a kind of guilty pleasure. I don't really feel at all bad about enjoying the entertainment of this show, of this season, because I know full well what's going on here, and we'll get into all of that in just a second. But, yeah, I it's just one of those things that I suppose I feel I wanted to address, that because this is such a pure example of intelligence service propaganda, and it is the CIA, it is, you know, top of the tree, really, in that regard. A lot of people, I suppose, in the alternative media have some kind of objection to enjoying this stuff, even if you know, to be able to enjoy it as entertainment, even if you do also get what else is going on here, the much more important stuff. And I suppose all I'm really doing is saying I don't think that's true. that I don't think there's any problem, there's anything wrong with enjoying a show like this, but also dissecting it and tearing it to pieces, which is what we're about to do. Anyway, we agreed before we recorded this that our basic kind of hypothesis about this season is that they're not only blending reality with fiction, which is, of course, what I suppose all fiction does, and particularly spy fiction does, but more specifically, they're trying to kind of blend the past, the present, and the future all together. They're not only mythologizing past events, real past events, but also some fabricated ones like the raid that supposedly killed bin Laden. They're not only mythologizing stuff like that, but they're also predicting future events at the same time. Mm. And we'll get into the details, but you think, I mean, do you think that's a fair hypothesis? That's basically what they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what's so striking about this season. We'd spoke many times before about, you know, the previous seasons are sort of, while, you know, there are some sort of real life sort of things like the whole Bo Bergdahl storyline. I mean, essentially, the past seasons were these sort of CIA fantasies where Iran and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda are all sort of, you know, work together at the Legion of Doom or whatever. And they're, everyone is connected in that sense, which is, again, I mean, it's kind of boring because you can rent any number of movies or watch any number of TV shows where that sort of meme is repeated over and over again. Whereas in this season, this time around, we're dealing almost exclusively with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and they really did go to great lengths to present us with a very real, outcome for this so-called, quote-unquote, withdrawal from Afghanistan, and how they will be, you know, ultimately involved forever in that region. And, as we'll get into, I mean, they really are presenting us with a very real possibility. And, of course, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the coming months in terms of Afghan Pakistan relations, relationships between the Taliban and other groups there as well. So I think this season really did program certain ideas into our mind, but more importantly, I think they're really sort of setting up the next sort of chess move in the sort of grand board of terrorism and the war on terror and all these sort of things together. So this is really a much more complex and a very subtle season in terms of the sort of little ideas that they're putting in there and the kind of propaganda, and I think that's why this is a much more enjoyable season, but it's also a much more interesting one to talk about because it's not these sort of cookie cutter evil and obviously there are cookie cutter terrorists in this, but as you'll see, I mean, you know, there's a lot more to all that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is that no spy show would be complete without the odd stereotype, but you're right that this is a much more sophisticated show than it was before. That's the thing that really struck me about this, is that they've stepped it up a gear in terms of what they're trying to do, and in fact what they accomplished. I actually think from an artistic point of view, this is an exceptionally good piece of propaganda. You know what I mean? I don't want to give them credit, if you like, for that, but I can't deny that they've done it well. I mean, to try and summarize the whole season, the whole of season four, with all of these convoluted plot twists, and it would be very difficult and perhaps rather pointless. I mean, if people have seen the show, then they know what we're talking about. And if they haven't, they're not going to really get the plot of the whole season by listening to, you know, a minute of me trying to lay it out for them. But the essentials are basically this. The season is essentially set in Pakistan. A bit in Afghanistan, but mostly in Pakistan, mostly based around the CIA station in the US Embassy in Islamabad. And Carrie and her merry band of CIA agents, they're battling it out, not just with this Taliban terrorist, who is extremely cunning, more cunning than any terrorist that's ever actually existed, with the exception of ones that, you know, are intelligence agents. But not only battling out with this Taliban terrorist, but also with the Pakistani ISI intelligence agency, who are in league with the Taliban. And so that is the jeopardy, that's the drama, that's the setup for the tension for the whole season. There are a few bits that I want to touch on. I do want to say, the opening episode, which is kind of what got us hooked on this season. They did it well, I can't deny it. You get this CIA airstrike on a Pakistani village, Donde Dar Pakel, which is a real village, and it has been the target of a number of high-profile drone strikes in real life, including one that is basically what happened in the show. It was in September 2008, and this killed dozens of people, including children, but it failed to kill either Jalaluddin Haqqani, who it was aimed at, or his son. They were the targets for this. And in Homeland, the airstrike is targeted on Donde Dar Pakel, and they're trying to kill Haysam Haqqani, who is this very thinly fictionalized version of Jalaluddin Haqqani, right down to that line about how they trained him back in the day.
Yes.
You remember that?
And of course,
the real Jalaluddin Haqqani was a CIA asset back in the Soviet-Afghan War, and therefore, of course, another person who was close friends with Bin Laden, who was CIA. So there's that. That whole thing is clearly a reworking of real events and real people. I don't think there can be any doubt about that. But then, of course, you get the weird thing that happened a few weeks after this episode aired. At the end of October, we got this story via RT. The title was "Top Commander of Feared Haqqani Network Killed in US Drone Strike." So this opening sequence, this opening event that kind of sets up the whole season, it's not only based on real past events, but it's also predicting future events at the exact same time. And that's something quite bold and quite ambitious to attempt, I think, in propaganda. But that seems to be what they've done, is it not?
Absolutely. And again, the whole that episode, which I believe is called The Drone Queen, which is the nickname that Carrie has when she is head of Afghan operations. It depicts, and again, it also just on a much broader sense, it depicts something that we have heard many times before about, apparently that wedding party in, the tribal region wasn't a giant terrorist training camp and, vaporized.
We killed 65 people.
Yeah, exactly. Whoops. Women and children and whatnot. And so they're presenting us with that idea. And again, it's to get Haqqani. They don't even change the guy's name. I mean, they're obviously referring to Jalaluddin Haqqani. But, like with so many of the things I think that we're going to start to explore here, that meme is turned around when we later find out that, of course, Haqqani was never there. And that, in fact, he orchestrated this whole thing. And, made it known that he was going to be at this wedding in part to sort of fake his own death so that he could do all these other wild things that he does in the series, but also to kind of make the CIA look like murderers. So again, a kind of a interesting little sort of subtle thing where, you're like, well, it's horrible they killed the wedding, but of course it wasn't really America's fault because, Haqqani tricked them. Sort of playing this weird sort of game with people's emotions and minds. And I think that's why the propaganda in this is so effective, because, while you might be sort of angry that Carrie is the drone queen, then on another level, you're like, well, it's all Haqqani's fault because he sort of lied to them. As if perhaps, what if Haqqani was there and he died? Would that make it better that, an entire village was wiped out in an airstrike? So the whole, that whole thing. And again, it's interesting that we're even talking about drones, because of course that seems sort of, this is a bad word to use, but antiquated in the war on terror. Drone strikes and these sort of things have sort of died off after, when Obama first came into office. Of course, I mean, he was the drone king, if Kerry was a drone queen.
Yep.
And that became very unpopular, both in America and especially in Pakistan. And, we sort of saw the whole drone thing taper off. And then, of course, Homeland comes out with this season and we're sort of back to the whole drone strike thing. And now, of course, we're seeing drone strikes increasing in Yemen. We're seeing them increase again in Pakistan. Obviously, we've just claimed that we've killed Haqqani. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if he, like many terrorists, rises up from the dead.
Well, and, to be clear, it's not. I don't think it's the same Haqqani. I think there are, in fact, several different Haqqanis in that network. So exactly which ones are supposed to be dead and alive is not clear, it's fair to say.
Right.
Yeah.
But all the same, we're being introduced into the whole drone strike thing, and I think it was very purposeful that they have them droning a wedding, but it's sort of not being the CIA's fault because Haqqani did this on purpose. So, you know, very interesting. And again, I think they're just sort of trying with so many of the storylines in this to get us used to this idea that no, drone strikes aren't really going away. They're going to be coming back again soon. And I don't know. I mean, I think as we'll see, I mean, I think they're also sort of, you know, I don't know, perhaps sort of wanting us to question the validity of the, you know, people who are claiming, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's just killing people. You know, these are just sort of evil, that they're pointless. And perhaps they're trying to introduce the idea that no, I mean, you know, if the intelligence was really, really, really good, then yeah, a drone strike would be okay. So, you know, I don't know if you want to pick up on that at all, Tom, or...
Sure. Well, I mean, to kind of substantiate where we're going with this and this idea that this is exactly what the CIA are doing with the show, because I think you're right. I'm not going to in any way dispute your interpretation of it there. But this is something I've wanted to kind of bring into an episode for a while, and I suppose this is absolutely the perfect opportunity. The CIA entertainment liaison back in the day, Chase Brandon, he actually inserted various ideas into a CIA-sponsored TV show of the time. This is back in 2002, 2003, including one about a... one about a Predator drone missile strike. And this was just on the cusp of this whole thing starting to be used operationally. You can read about this in an article called Hollywood Hitmen, which is in the Fortean Times, which is a wonderful publication.
Yes.
And also you can read about it in Trisha Jenkins' book, The CIA in Hollywood. And the source for the story is impeccable. It's the producer of the show, The Agency, which was the show we're talking about. This ran back in, I think it was 2001 to about 2004. The producer of the show was called Michael Beckner, and he worked very closely with Chase Brandon when they were making this show. And in the Fortean Times article, it says that Brandon phoned him to suggest a plotline involving biometric identification technology. When Beckner questioned Brandon on the show's on the story's realism, Brandon told him, "Put it in there, whether we have it or not. Terrorists watch TV too; it'll scare them." For another episode, Brandon suggested using a Predator drone outfitted with a Hellfire missile to kill a Pakistani general, asking Beckner to see how it plays out, how you could make it work. 1 month after the show aired, the CIA assassinated a Pakistani general using Hellfire missiles from a Predator drone. "I'm not a big conspiracy theorist," says Beckner, "but there seems to have been a unique synergy there." I love the way he says, "I'm not a big conspiracy
theorist." Right, right, right. Yeah,
obviously,
yeah.
I'm a bit of a conspiracy
theorist. Right, yeah. How could you not after that?
And just for the record, the episode in question was Series 1, Episode 19, called Peacemakers of the Agency. I mean, but what do you make of this, Pierce? This seems to be, like, the most explicit admission I've ever come across, that this is exactly they're doing.
Well, and that article you're talking about is extremely fascinating and worth a read, because there's a lot more, and with Beckner and Brandon and some of these other things. But no, I mean, I think that this is... I mean, as you said, I mean, this is just sort of further and reinforcing, you know, this isn't just me and Tom's sort of a wild opinion of the show. This really is a very real thing. And, you know, and if we've got Chase Brandon, who you've, you know, chronicled, I mean, very close connections with Hollywood and culture creation and the CIA, you know, implanting that back then, I mean, just imagine now. And again, you know, when you have these advisors on these TV shows, you know, of course, they might sort of present an idea that would seem sort of far-fetched, as he was saying, you know, well, but do you even have that? And, well, put it in anyway, because A, terrorists watch it, and B, you know, we probably will have it at some point, so it's fine. It doesn't, you know, and again, the perception, of course, will be that we do have it, and mm-hmm. perhaps that's even more powerful than if... if they did have biometric scanners that could do such and such a thing. So I think that the fact that this season of Homeland is focusing primarily on Pakistan, a little bit on Afghanistan, and ultimately about what's going to happen with the withdrawal is very deliberate. And again, this introduction of drones and drone strikes is also deliberate because, again, this is happening again. We are seeing the drone campaign step up. And even just a few days ago, in yet another announcement from the White House that we're not really leaving Afghanistan. One of the things that was hammered out with the President Ghani, the new president in Afghanistan, was that drones could start flying all over Afghanistan again, and that drone strikes will be used as backup for operations between the United States and the Afghan army. So, you know, this is all deliberate. And I think, again, the fact that they bombed a wedding is deliberate because that's, you know, that is sort of the key, you know, talking point as to why drones are horrible, because they are totally inaccurate. And, you know, the CIA fucks up all the time. So, you know, yeah, I think this is just all part of this very subtle propaganda and sort of predictive programming. And unfortunately, I think, you know, this show, the series Homeland, made a lot of people sort of turn on Bo Bergdahl and see this man who was, for all intents and purposes, I mean, treated probably horribly by his captors, who included supposedly the Haqqani network at one point. And when this man returned to, I mean, I don't even know how you could return to this sort of life, he was instantly labeled as a traitor, as a, you know, an agent, that he was a Muslim now. And, you know, Homeland definitely colored everybody's image of him. So again, with the drone strike at the wedding, ooh, but it was really the terrorist's fault because he was, you know, he was supposed to be there and he wasn't. Again, they are,
you know, such a lame excuse, but you're right.
Exactly.
You're right. That
is
the logic that they're using. Yeah.
They are coloring our opinion into thinking that, well, maybe drones aren't all that bad. And I think as we'll get into with some of the other major memes and ideas and real life events that are depicted in this, there is this sort of, you know, like all good CIA shows, at the end of the day, the company is always, you know, kind of the good guy, even if they do horrible things. Ultimately, their agenda is justified no matter what. So,
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the thing I wanted to move on to, was just some of the examples. We could not list all of the examples of real life events that were portrayed in this season of Homeland. It would take all night, frankly. But just to list a few of them here. There is, of course, the strike on Dondai Darpakel, which was targeting Haqqani. There is the CIA station chief in Islamabad, who is exposed and murdered on the streets in a fight that was very, very reminiscent of the Ray Davis case. If people don't know about this, Raymond Davis was a CIA contractor who is reported to have been the CIA station chief, but may not have been. And he got into some kind of dirty business on the streets of Islamabad and got into a bit of trouble and killed someone, and ended up having to, well, basically the CIA paid, I think it was in the end, paid a couple of $100,000 in blood money to get him out of it. So not that that's exactly what happens in Homeland, but the action sequence whereby the station chief is killed is very similar to the descriptions of what was going on with Ray Davis and how he got into all this trouble. And you have an interesting little story, do you not, Pierce, about the actor who plays the CIA station chief?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, his name in the show is Sandy Bachman, and I can't remember what his real name is, but call it synchronicity or happenstance or something, but a few days ago, we were, you know, in this, you know, ongoing, basically I woke up and you had emailed me about the latest episode, and we were emailing each other back and forth all day, you know, talking about the show and this and that. And as I was leaving to go home and I walked into the subway station, who was standing on the platform talking to his girlfriend, none other than Sandy Bachman. And
alive and well.
yeah. Yes, exactly. Alive and well. And I didn't say hello to him. Just because I always feel like, A, who cares? It's a celebrity and who gives a shit? And also, you know, that's why a lot of celebrities live in New York, because most people don't really give a crap. So they can ride the subway and take taxis and no one really bothers them. But
he was only in it for one episode, so I don't know if he could have told as much about the CIA anyway.
No. But, you know, Sandy, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure me and Tom would love to have you on and get your opinion on Homeland.
Anyway, so other things that are real life. I mean, Haqqani is the character, Haysam Haqqani, is not only based on the real Jalaluddin Haqqani, but also he is sort of representative of the whole Haqqani network, is he mm-hmm. not? I mean, that's sort of what they're using him for. That's why they're using that name. And because, of course, it was the Haqqani network who... Was it them who kidnapped Bo Bergdahl in the first place?
I can't... If I remember correctly, it wasn't the Haqqani network that initially captured him. It was the Taliban. And according to... there are so many kind of conflicting stories as to what happened. And, I mean, still no one really knows exactly why he left... What happened, in the sort of hours after Bergdahl left his post. But yes, it is believed that it's at some point he was in, under Haqqani's power or whatever, that the Haqqani network were the people who were holding him for the longest period of time. And of course, this, you know, then leads into all sorts of other sort of, you know, theories as to... you know, who Bo Bergdahl was and what connections he might have had. And, it brings up the whole sort of, connections between the Haqqani network and the CIA and the ISI and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, again, the fact that they said Haqqani, I mean, was almost so blatant that, and there are a couple moments in this season where they will be so, you know, truly amazing in the writing and crafting of these sort of subtle little storylines. And then they'll just kind of beat it over your head, like, you know, calling him Haqqani. I mean, they could have come up with any name and essentially you would have known who this guy was, especially when they're like, oh, you know, we trained him. He fought on our side against the evil Soviets. So sort of bizarre, some of those little things. And I can't help but think that those were some CIA guy telling them, no, that you're going to put this in there. We definitely want, you know, at least, you know, there's going to be some group of people out there that need that sort of blunt, you know, sort of being beaten over the head with this idea. And I think that's why they just chose to just outright, you know, Haqqani network. Of course, the show never really gets into the intricacies of, like the Haqqani network, the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban. These are all different entities. Mm-hmm. And while their agendas line up along the same lines, I mean, they're much more complex. And, the Haqqani network is even sort of devolved into more or less like just like a organized crime, you know, like a mafioso syndicate. And it's no longer quite the kind of ideological bend that it used to have, if it ever did have that.
Well, they do allude to that in the show, don't they? Because when there's the bit when they are doing a prisoner exchange, when they're swapping five Haqqani network members for Saul Berenson, the CIA ex-director who gets kidnapped. and they're sort of, you know, explain, there's that bit where the guy's walking down the line and explaining who these guys are. And it's a lot, it's very reminiscent of that bit in like a gangster movie where the guy's got a bunch of specialists together and he's saying, you know, this is the explosives guy and this is the assailants guy and blah, blah, blah. It's very sort of odd that they did that with five guys that are supposed to be terrorists.
Oh, and they even have the, you know, oh, that's Haqqani's, top opium trafficker.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. These guys sounded much more like a bunch of like Islamic mafia than they did any kind of radical terrorist, you know, fanatic group or whatever. Mm. Yeah. But, I mean, what I was going to say was, So even more strangely, because obviously Brody is somewhat inspired by the Bo Bergdahl story. There is no two ways about it.
No.
And of course, was kidnapped, held, comes back looking exactly the same as Bo Bergdahl did when he was first released. All of this. I mean, you covered this very, very well in your show on the whole Bo Bergdahl thing. But here again, we have another person getting kidnapped. We have Saul Berenson being kidnapped by, effectively, the Haqqani network. So they're playing the same storyline that drove the first three seasons, effectively, of Homeland. They've kind of recycled it, because obviously it worked the first time so well. But, I mean, there's so much we could say about the whole Saul getting kidnapped escapade. I mean, it's sort
someone
of
needed to retrain Saul in how to be a spy, because he was not very effective at tailing someone in an airport. Let's just put it that way.
No. Or at escaping.
For about
2 minutes there, he remembered his spy training, and he manages to kill the guard and runs out of the compound, and even takes a phone with him.
Yeah.
He even remembers to do that. But then as soon as he gets outside, he's completely useless. He's like, right. You know, he's phoning up Carrie saying, I'm lost. I'm in the middle of the desert. I can't see a damn thing. I don't know where I'm going.
It's like, get it together, Saul.
Yeah. But also, he looked... after he gets rescued and he's, you know, got all the sort of bruises and scars and what have you, he did look an awful lot like the pictures of Terry Waite, the famous British hostage who was held in Beirut, I think it was, for like 4 years, 5 years. Mm. There was a certain, you know, visual resemblance there. I suppose the most important thing that's sort of real life that's being fictionalized or mythologized in this is, of course, the ISI-CIA relationship, because you have in this season, they do, I think it's actually quite realistically portrayed in some respects, because they do kind of portray the CIA as sort of stamping around, just doing whatever the hell they like, and the ISI as sort of playing them and playing the Taliban, and to some extent playing both sides against the middle, but you have a feeling their long-term loyalty is probably closer to the Taliban in Afghanistan, because that makes more sense to them than getting into bed with the CIA. I mean, what do you make of this? Is this an attempt to throw us off what's really going on, or is it actually quite accurate? What do you feel on that one?
I'm not entirely sure, and I know we talked about this in our emails, because I for a variety of reasons, have a tremendous interest in Pakistan as a country and its politics, and probably the only good professor I had at college was Pakistani, and she really kind of introduced me to a whole range of ideas that I had never heard about in regards to not only just how complex and beautiful the culture of Pakistan is, but the really sort of complex relationship between the ISI, the CIA, Saudi Arabia, how all of these sort of overlapping factors are working together, and just sort of how, to a degree, Pakistan is sort of stuck in a very difficult position. You know, geostrategically, they are extremely important. I mean, you're talking about this just, you know, the nexus of so many different things, you know, weapons trafficking, exporting jihadis, the drug trade, oil pipelines, you name it, are there. And, you know, for better or worse, they've sort of made, you know, their alliance with the CIA and with the West. And they, you know, we used Pakistan to a very large degree to create the very problem that we are now claiming that we have to fight and conquer. And, you know, all blame is put on these, you know, psycho Pakistanis who, you know, just they love the Taliban and all of these groups. When, of course, I mean, we were the ones who were, you know, coming with dump trucks full of money, telling them, well, give it to whoever the hell you want, as long as, you know, they do our bidding, essentially. So I don't know. And I think, at least from my take on this, I really saw the kind of relationship or the way that they portrayed the Pakistanis as a little bit harsh at times. And I felt that they were, again, playing up this idea that, you know, the Pakistanis are just sort of, you know, out to screw the Americans at every chance they get. And I think it is certainly, you know, real that the Pakistanis are kind of playing their own game, Which is not, obviously, it's a very horrible game and involves a lot of people dying, but ultimately, I mean, they're trying to preserve their own country, and they're, you know, they're not really going to rely on the Americans to help them do that. So, you know, that is realistic. But again, you know, it's sort of like there's all these, you know, there's a reference early on from the CIA director character Lockhart where he's like, oh, it's not even a real freaking country, you know, it's just an acronym. And, you know, every 5 minutes, I mean, Kerry or someone else, I don't trust those fucking ISI guys. And
There was this distinct attempt to demonize them.
Yes.
Even beyond, I mean, I suppose I'm saying that the relationship in kind of the broad terms that they laid it out, I thought was quite accurate. But you're right.
Yeah.
It's clear that beyond that, CIA equals good, ISI equals bad. It's what we're supposed to take away from this. And that, you know, I would say both of them are pretty bad, to be honest.
Yeah, no, exactly. And again, I think it is accurate, the sort of game that we see the ISI playing. Because, yes, I mean, of course, they are aligned with the Taliban, if not, you know, outright with certain factions, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's sort of the logical conclusion. I mean, they're not going to conquer these people. You know, the Taliban is there. They're not going away anytime soon. So, you know, it makes sense for the ISI and the military and other factions within the Pakistani deep state to ally themselves with those groups. And again, I guess my sort of irritation with this, and obviously a show like Homeland isn't going to admit it, but you know the CIA know all of this already.
Yes.
This is not a secret. And instead, in Homeland, I mean, we you know these Kerry or Saul or Lockhart, you know, it's how could you work with those crazy psychos? And of course, I mean, we helped the Pakistanis create these crazy psychos.
Well, and why is the CIA-ISI relationship so important? It's precisely because they've got their hooks into things like this, and so they can, you know, provide us with our conveyor belt of jihadis for various different purposes that we want.
And that, you know, is never explored. I mean, they never really state in the show, well, you know, if you don't trust these people, if you think that they're all, you know, these radical jihadis, then, I mean, why the hell is this so important? Then, you know, why not cut off relations? You know, why not really, you know, I don't know, expose this or something? You know, there are obviously multiple times when they could be like, you know, you're protecting Haqqani, you're doing this, you know, we have some evidence. But of course, they never say that. And again, this is ultimately because they do know what is going on. And of course, they are that, you know, Pakistan is in many ways the West sort of enforcer in South Asia. You know, we no longer have Iran to use as an enforcer in that region. So we use Pakistan. And, you know, again, I mean, the whole, you know, Operation Cyclone, all of these things in the 1980s, I mean, we had to know to some degree what we were getting into.
And let's face it, it's because of that that Pakistan became a nuclear power, not just in terms of diplomatically the West turning a blind eye to what Pakistan was doing with nuclear technology, but also in terms of actually at one point giving them some of the technology.
Yes.
So, and this was all part of, you know, keeping them sweet so that we could keep Operation Cyclone going, so that we could keep harassing and bleeding the Russians out in Afghanistan. That was the whole point of that. And so, yeah, you're right. The fact that all of this is in Homeland, despite it being so based in reality, it's pretends that all of this context never actually happened, and this all comes as some kind of shock to the CIA to that this is what's going on, when of course in reality, as you say, they know full well. But moving on in the list of real things, the female ISI chief, who is a who becomes a very important character, and in the very last episode, I think she's even on TV sort of running for office. And this is, of course, ironic, because she is, in some ways, a sort of younger, prettier Benazir Bhutto, is she not?
Mm-hmm.
As the season progresses, they kind of make her look more and more like that. And I think particularly with that storyline at the end, where it seems that she's now becoming a political figure. That's what they're doing with her. I don't see that there's any other way really to see that. And But finally, or at least in my list, the attack that happens in a couple of episodes before the end, the big attack on the US embassy in Islamabad that is carried out by Haqqani and his network and is sort of sponsored and assisted by the ISI. This is all reminiscent of the attack, not only the attack on that very embassy, the US embassy in Pakistan, which got burned to the ground in 1979, but much more recently and much more importantly to what happened in Benghazi. I mean, firstly, is there anything you specifically, before we get into Benghazi, is there anything you wanted to add to that list? Or?
Oh, no, just that I think that the Benazir Bhutto, reference with this Pakistani character is really important, again, because we have in the show Homeland, we have this, beautiful Pakistani ISI agent who seems to just absolutely love Haqqani or sees no real problem with a woman allying herself with a man who, I mean, for all intents and purposes, would kill her in a second. This sort of mimics Benazir Bhutto's tacit agreements with the Taliban. And of course, there was just a few days ago more evidence coming out that not the bombing that eventually killed her, but that the first attempt on Benazir Bhutto's life was in fact orchestrated with Taliban sympathizers or some sort of Taliban faction, Islamist faction against her. So I think that'll be a really interesting parallel that maybe we will see happening later.
We did think that they were going to kill off the character in this season, but it seems that they may be playing a longer game with that character now that they're sort of turning her into a Benazir Bhutto, into a political figure. Perhaps she's going to turn up in the next season and then end up dying in a remarkably similar incident to how Benazir Bhutto really got killed. It wouldn't surprise us, would it?
No, not at all. Not at all.
But one of the times when we were batting around ideas in the middle of this season about where it was headed, I did suggest that this is going to culminate in an attack on the embassy of some sort, and then backed away from the idea, and then that actually happened. So don't read too much into my predictions, I think, is the lesson here. But you said that your sister actually suggested to you that one of the main purposes of this season was to rewrite what happened in Benghazi, to sort of mythologize that. And I was hoping you could just sort of briefly highlight some of the parallels here. Because sure. I think you're right. I think that is one of the main purposes of this season.
Yeah, I think that the Benghazi storyline is in many ways might be the most important aspect of this whole season, for a number of reasons that we'll get into. But definitely the narrative of the Benghazi story here, at least in the U.S., I mean, has completely fallen apart. And while it's no longer the sort of talking point that it was, a few months ago or a year ago or whatever, the CIA and, I mean, Washington, this sort of establishment has never really come up with a very clear narrative as to what happened. Of course, we had the first story was that, oh, this was just a riot that got out of hand because they saw this movie on YouTube called The Innocence of Muslims that depicted Muhammad and, that was...
that was the story they were going with. Yeah.
That fell apart in about 20 minutes, and they had to come up with another version. And they've come up with several so far. So, but what's interesting about Homeland is that it... talking about Benghazi for a minute, there are some obvious things that they just can no longer deny. So we have Christopher Stevens, the ambassador, there with several CIA contractors or agents. It's never quite clear. There is a large CIA annex that they called it within this Benghazi compound that has never quite been explained. And there are some pretty, I would say, very probable allegations that this is part of some sort of, weapons program that was taking place within Libya and exporting weapons to Syria. But we don't have to get into all of that. But, keep in mind that there is obviously this CIA connection with what happened. Now, what happens in Homeland, of course, is that we have the ambassador The Pakistani, the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, is married to this very pathetic kind of scumbag guy who I absolutely loved every minute of him in the show because he was just amazingly great.
He was a weaselly little shit. But yeah, it was fantastic to watch him.
And it turns out that this guy Dennis, aside from being a noted plagiarist in America, in academia, he's also helping to give information to the ISI. And apparently we find out that he had been doing this with the former station chief who gets killed, like Ray Davis. And then when he dies, the ISI official, who is now the sort of Benazir Bhutto character, approaches Dennis and is like, well, we need more information. Keep doing it or else we're going to expose that you've been leaking, classified information. Anyway, Dennis reveals to them that there is a secret passage under the, I believe it's the economics department, that is only known to the CIA and, the ambassador and a few other people. Dennis doesn't seem to think that this is odd to give up this information. And Dennis becomes quite shocked and appalled that, in fact, Haqqani uses the secret tunnel to get into the facility and takes over. And, they start executing people and they are trying to get this list of every known asset. But I think this is important because, like all good lies, there has to be an element of truth in that. And perhaps that can be true about, propaganda or the sort of rewriting of history, because, again, it mimics the Benghazi story, not just in that, this radical Islamic, army or a group of people goes in and attacks. But again, like with Benghazi, I mean, they're mixing in elements of the CIA and that there could have been some sort of collusion going on. Of course, in this, it's just this sort of slimy character, Dennis.
It's all one individual was colluding.
Right, and exactly.
There's nothing more to it than that. Whereas with Benghazi, it must have been, it just must have been some kind of more operational collusion.
Exactly.
That led
right.
to this.
And I think that, that episode and that whole sort of aftermath of that is really important because, again, I mean, culture creation is can be very simple, but it can also be kind of complex like this. And I think that by implanting these little ideas like that, it starts to, again, sort of color your idea about what happened at Benghazi. And again, Benghazi, allegedly there were all sorts of security problems and that this had been reported and, Hillary Clinton didn't care about it or, she claimed, oh, I'm sorry. It was just, oversight on my, and again, in the Islamabad attack in Homeland, almost all of the security is sent outside to this RPG attack. And there's this sort of, there's seemingly this like one guy with a gun and Quinn, who is
this one guy who looks character. About 14 as well.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And they're, sort of meant to sort of save everything. So again, I think this all contributes to programming, the average person to thinking that, well, maybe there was something else to Benghazi, but it there might have been some CIA shenanigans, but it was probably just a stupid mistake. The same way that in Homeland, yeah, there were some sort of weird things going on, but it was just that idiot Dennis.
Yeah,
And that might seem like a very kind of like, childish viewpoint, but I think that the blending of reality and fiction right now is, and we've talked about this before, Tom, I mean, it's reaching this point where you almost can't tell anymore, and it almost doesn't really matter, what really happened at Benghazi, what really happened in Homeland. It no longer really matters because at the end of the day, of course, I mean, they don't even care. They're just like, well, we've got to get Haqqani now, because he put the Islamic flag over the embassy, and this is so horrible. I think that that whole storyline is extremely important because it really kind of gets into the core of where the show is going, where they're blending everything to such a degree where you really can't tell the difference anymore between, fiction and reality. And
give it another year and people won't be able to remember, was that something on Homeland or was that part of the Benghazi story?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it is a childish point to make because I hear this all the time when people are... when I sort of engage with people who are very much outside of, you know, these sorts of circles, and I don't, you know, try and hammer things home with them, I just sort of I'll offer them a kind of a different perspective on something, and they'll say, oh, no, it's like in that TV show, it's just like that. And that is actually the ready-made excuse they have for, you know, if I'm talking about whatever, CIA assassinations, just as an example. And I'll say, you know, this is an uninterrupted program that they've basically been doing throughout their entire existence. There is nothing, you know, exceptional or unusual or going rogue or anything about this. This is just what they do. And you know, someone will come back, oh, no, it's just like, you know, it's just like, it's like in the Bourne Identity or something. It's, you know, it's not like that, because they don't want to think this is just how these people think. This is how they behave. This is how they act. And they do. They absolutely do. And I think partly because, you know, there is that psychological motivation to not want to believe in that. When you're given the ready-made excuse through a TV show that appears to be, you know, quite, you know, well-researched and quite intelligent and seems to be very well-informed, and maybe you see an article saying, oh, you know, they spoke to a few ex-CIA people, and you think, oh, they must know what they're talking about. And so people take it seriously, and people think this is actually, you know, the model for understanding the world. And just to kind of hammer it home with Benghazi, I suppose the point that I'd really like to highlight is that they portray, just as Benghazi has been at worst portrayed as some kind of blowback, it's the same in Homeland. It's just, oh, well, it was still Haqqani who did it. It was just, you know, this was the, they didn't mean for this to happen in any way. It was just that sneaky Dennis who, he didn't even realize that this is what they were doing and this is what was going to happen. So you can't even really blame him too much for the attack. And, you know, it fudges it all over. It makes it all seem like, oh, it's just a mistake or some kind of accident or whatever.
Well, and that's
no one to blame. You know.
And that's part of this whole, with Ambassador Stevens, I mean, you're talking about a guy who was openly meeting with all sorts of really, really awful, you know, quote-unquote freedom fighters in Libya. He was very instrumental in, you know, organizing a lot of these NATO shipments of arms and whatnot to the different, the so-called freedom fighters and rebels.
You've got to remember,
Libya,
though, these are the moderate Islamist cannibals that he's dealing
right,
with.
Right, yeah.
So...
So again, you know, and so, you know, like with Benghazi, I mean, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, Christy, you know, that might be blowback. Maybe we shouldn't, you know, maybe that was the one group of his freedom fighters we shouldn't have aligned ourselves with. But that's okay because, you know, the other good ones got the other, you know, they got weapons too, so that they can kind of, you know, put them down or whatnot. So, yeah, I think this is a really important thing. And just to kind of one more little point on that, this sort of blending of these two things together really says a lot about like where the society is being pushed, because again, we're constantly supposed to be afraid of terrorism and to think that everyone is a terrorist or anyone could be a terrorist, to be disgusted, you know, to this degree with these people that, you know, bombing an entire country seems totally okay. And yet pop culture and entertainment revolves almost entirely around these issues and these ideas. And, you know, it's not just Homeland. Now there's a whole string of shows coming out that are copying Homeland. And it, you know, it's really just interesting how, you know, entertainment is supposed to be an escape, and our escape is to kind of go into this world that is happening all, you know, the war on terror is real. It's going on everywhere. Now, you know, you go to the movies to escape, but you go to watch these intelligence connected films, you know, or TV shows, giving you a very warped view, but albeit, you know, very well done, like in Homeland, for instance. So I think that's just a really interesting point. And has it, I don't know, that says a lot about society and where entertainment is going to nowadays.
I mean, you're right. I mean, when the thing that you're escaping to is some kind of CIA wet dream, it's slightly depressing, really. Anyway, let's move on, shall we? You're right, but let's move on. There is, of course, some rather entertaining casting in this season, which is what first piqued my interest, I must say, when I was reading some of the preview articles and things on this season. And I noticed, oh, they've got a couple of my favorite actors. I mean, firstly, not that he actually, I don't think, appears in this season, which is Carrie's father. I only realized this recently. I mean, in the season, they kill off the character. He dies. And I think this is because the actor himself actually died earlier this year. So again, something that's, you know, real. But he actually previously appeared in the film Meet the Parents, which, believe it or not, is actually a CIA-sponsored comedy. So, yeah.
Just
a man with a little bit of a history there. But much more interestingly, we have Art Malik, of course, who plays the senior ISI agent. And we talked a lot about Art Malik in the True Lies, Real Bad Arabs episode that we did over the summer. And yeah, I like the guy. I think I like watching him on the screen, but
yeah.
this is a man who rather tragically seems to mostly make his living off portraying bad guys in state-sponsored pop culture. And it's
at least in this, he got to play a Pakistani guy. Art Malik in real life is Pakistani. I think he was British born, but he is Pakistani. Sure. But usually he plays the sort of stark raving mad, the real bad Arab in all sorts of movies. True Lies probably being the biggest one. So at least this time he got to play, a nice Pakistani guy in an expensive suit. Not going around with a, balaclava and, screaming about Allah or something like that, in some of these really just awful movies that he makes. And he is kind of an interesting character in this. And,
Hello?
Tom?
Sorry, you went silent there for a moment.
Oh, sorry. Well, I was just saying, thank God Art Malik gets to play a Pakistani. And his character in this, General Lateef, is sort of interesting. A little bit more complex than he usually gets to play in a lot of these state-sponsored movies.
Well, and we also, of course, have Raza Jaffrey, who I've come across this guy in quite a lot of my research because he turns up so much in the 7-7 predictive programming and things like that. I mean, just this guy is a very British, very, very British actor. And it's rather curious that they got these two guys with very British accents to play the two Pakistani ISI figures. Could they not get anyone with a genuine... Well, they clearly couldn't get anyone with a genuine Pakistani accent, because even Ayan is played by an Indian guy. Like.
Yes, a main character.
Yeah, and he has a very obviously Indian accent. Whenever he gets sort of agitated or upset, the Indian in his accent really, really comes through. And anyone who has an ear for these kind of things and knows the difference between an Indian and a Pakistani accent will just hear that straight away and say, that guy's not Pakistani. He's never really been to Pakistan. And of course, the series, even though it's entirely set in Pakistan, was filmed in Cape Town.
Right.
I suppose it's not that far away.
It works.
Yeah. Well, it did. But yeah, Raza Jaffrey, he appeared in this BBC-HBO dual project about a year and a half before 7-7, a sort of TV, made-for-TV movie called Dirty War, which even features two Muslim suicide bombers attacking Liverpool Street tube station. It's that, predictive of 7-7. He then goes on he switches from being a terrorist to being a MI5 agent and appears in Spooks, of course, which is basically the MI5 equivalent of Homeland. Or more like, it was slightly earlier on, so it's more like, I suppose, the MI5 BBC equivalent of Alias or 24, or The Agency, which of course we mentioned earlier. Now he turns up on Homeland as an ISI agent whose colleagues are in league with the terrorists. So he keeps switching sides, this guy. He doesn't seem to be able to make up his mind which side he's trying to play. But he's another actor who, like Art Malik, seems to be rather tragically typecast. He only seems to be able to make a career appearing in these sorts of programs and films and things.
We talked about that when we were talking about Real Bad Arabs and just that whole thing. I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, these guys like never, get to make just like a movie where they're just, a regular person. they have to be a terrorist, or they have to be Pakistani, or something like that, or they have to be kind of, and even Art Malik in this is, quite reasonable. He doesn't come off like a you know, crazy at all. He is good friends with Saul from, you know, way back in Operation Cyclone or something.
Yeah, I don't know what's it, yeah, where they're supposed to be friends.
Yeah, from, but yeah. They know each other. You know, Saul refers to him as Bunny.
That's really
an
weird.
Odd name for a, you know, Pakistani ISI general. But again, they can't totally let Art Malik off the hook there because Art Malik is a conspiracy theorist in the show. And they definitely, you know, go to lengths to make him look like a nut job because he questions the whole Abbottabad raid, which, you know, again, it's some more of this mythologizing that we have going on here. And that whole scene is so bizarre, you know, because Saul basically just is like, shut up, you're stupid. Anyone that thinks that is a lunatic. The CIA, you know, totally got him. And then that's sort of the end of that whole sequence between them. And that's the last time they actually meet. So, yeah, again, I mean, Art Malik, even when he's sort of playing the as nice a guy as he's going to, you know, they kind of have to one up him. And, you know, I'd be interested to see what or to know what they think about all of this, because, you know, it's especially in Homeland. I mean, there's almost never a good, you know, Muslim character or Arab character or. You know, or if they are, they're the, you know, like in the previous seasons, the only good Arab was the, you know, half Lebanese, half Venezuelan. So this guy looked, you know, just like a Venezuelan guy. He was the only good Muslim. Of course, Carrie, you know, didn't trust him either. You know, and again, in this, the only other good Muslim gets killed, which is Farah.
we'll get on to that in a bit, but I did want to pick up on this whole 9/11 thing, because there's a couple of references to this in the series. There is, like you say, there's that one, they're both conversations with Saul, and the important thing to understand about him is he's kind of the voice of reason, the wise old man of the show, at least until he gets kidnapped. but he's the guy who sort of, his judgment isn't really supposed to be in doubt. He's very much an authority figure for the audience, I suppose. And so there, you have this scene where he sat down with the ISI general, played by Art Malik, who tells him 9/11 was a hoax, his word, and an American-Israeli plot to justify a crusade against Muslims. And then Saul just counters this by saying, oh, that's ridiculous, and he refuses to have the conversation. He refuses for it to go any further. And I thought this was quite interesting, because they'd not just presented a alternative 9/11 conspiracy theory, but they'd given you the version that's like the Islamic version, where it has to be, you know, that this is some kind of Israeli crusade rather than, oh, I don't know, that it's a geopolitical plot about oil. It's a different, probably equally simplistic and flawed narrative of 9/11, but you know what I mean. It's sort of that flavor. They've set up something of a straw man, because most people don't think of it in those terms. I don't really think there is anything particularly incriminating regarding Israel, or at least no more incriminating than, say, Britain, Germany, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. There's a lot of incriminating stuff leading back in a lot of different directions on 9/11. So the idea that it is just that, I think, is just narrow and inaccurate.
Oh yeah, I completely agree. I mean, like all deep state events, there are lots of players and there are lots of moving parts. And you know, just because there are, you know, you can find sort of bizarre instances or things involving Israel on the day of 9/11 doesn't mean that that this was all is, you know, Zionist plot. And like you said, I mean, that's a straw man. I mean, it's such a base sort of gut reaction. I mean, it's like saying 9/11 was an inside job. I mean, it's lost all of its meaning. And to say that this is just you know, Zionist plot is I mean, it's not intellectually stimulating enough for me, you know.
Or just as a similar example, say that the whole war on terror is just a Christian Jewish crusade, or just a Christian crusade. It's like, you know, you got to move on from such simplistic explanations for things, because the world is a bit more complex than that, and things like 9/11 certainly.
I mean, you could look at 9/11 and say, well, it was all the banks, you know? I mean, there's so much, there's so many people that benefited from this.
Yes, that's certainly true. And a similar kind of thing with Saul's refutation of this, that he goes, oh, it's like those people who say that the Abbottabad raid never actually happened and that Bin Laden is still alive. And of course, no one thinks that Bin Laden's still alive. I don't know anyone who believes that. I've never come across that perspective, honestly. Most people think he was dead a long, long time before the Abbottabad raid. That's the point. That's the actual alternative version of that event. But, you know, and so again, you've got a sort of straw man being brushed down with a non-argument that no one ever makes. So, yeah.
Really interesting. And again, I mean, it's almost kind of like, why even bring up 9/11 in this context? You know, that was fascinating, just because, it seems so sort of far back. And I mean, it seems like, you know, they're getting rid of Al-Qaeda. I mean, notice no one says Al-Qaeda anymore. No one thinks that they're really a threat. I mean, you know, what is Ayman al-Zawahiri doing? Nothing. You know, it's all ISIS this or the Taliban. Obviously, that's the other big, the boogeyman that still hasn't, you know, gone away. So, bringing up 9/11 is bizarre in and of itself in this show. And again, it's that scene, like some other things, really just kind of hits you over the head. And you're just like, you're crazy if you think that. Don't be a conspiracy theorist. Despite the fact that this entire season is about a massive conspiracy involving the ISI, the Taliban, and even the CIA to a degree.
Yeah. But let's not dwell too much on their massive hypocrisy over the question of conspiracy. I mean, the other quick mention of 9/11 comes in this very crude bit of dialogue where Saul is talking to Haqqani, who's kidnapped him at this point. And Saul mentions 9/11, and Haqqani says, oh, no, that wasn't us. That was Al-Qaeda. And so you have, you know, even if the terrorist is saying it was Al-Qaeda, then, of course, it must have been Al-Qaeda who did 9/11. So the only two mentions of it in this whole season are clearly just about buttressing and trying to reinforce this official bullshit story. Although, in truth, you could say it was Al-Qaeda, but it depends on what you mean by Al-Qaeda. If you understand that name to be the name of a massive intelligence operation, then it was Al-Qaeda, in a manner of speaking. But, yeah, you're right. That's a term that seems to have now largely been dropped. They don't seem to be interested in that anymore. And very much it's switching to ISIS and the Taliban. And I think these are the next two chapters, the next two phases in the war on terror, as I see it. I don't think there's much reason to doubt that. And everything in this season of Homeland seems to be indicating that's where they're going. But moving on to another theme that's kind of interesting, beheadings, because I couldn't avoid touching on this. I mean, what with the ISIS, in big inverted commas, the ISIS videos over the summer and all the nonsense that came out of that and how that has clearly fed into this series of Homeland. And of course, two lines, once again, there's two little references here that jumped out at me, and they're both from CIA director Andrew Lockhart. And Lockhart will be a very familiar name to students of intelligence history, but he's a character I adore. Because he's so good at faking being a hard ass.
Yes, yeah.
When deep down he's a complete coward. And I find that really very entertaining to watch. But yeah, the first line, which of course you highlighted to me, it's when Saul's been kidnapped and imprisoned, and Lockhart says something like, I'm not going to let him end up like Daniel Pearl and Jim Foley with his head in a basket, as though there was any threat that Saul was going to be beheaded. But you said, very interesting that they call him Jim Foley.
Yes. I have not heard anyone refer to James Foley, the first journalist who was beheaded allegedly by ISIS. I've never heard anyone refer to him as Jim, which is, it is odd, because again, James Foley's connections with the CIA are real. His affiliations with Matthew Van Dyke should be a clear signal that this guy was a little bit more than just a journalist. I mean, he totally towed the CIA army line in all of his writing. Along with Stephen Sotloff, there were, you know, allegations that they were, you know, connected in some other way. So the CIA director calling James Foley Jim seems a little like a kind of a wink and a nod. And we see that in all sorts of CIA-sponsored not just movies, but I mean newspapers and, you know, news outlets. I mean, they will sort of throw in little things like that. But again, really kind of just it really sort of stuck out with me because, I mean, I've never even heard his parents refer to him as Jim. In interviews. I've never heard Van Dyke or some of these other people who were friends with him refer to him as Jim. So to have the head of the CIA referring to James Foley as Jim with his affiliations with these people, not to mention the fact that, I mean, the whole beheading thing was so orchestrated. And I mean, I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit, but I mean, was definitely more than, you know, this was a psyop of psyops. I mean, you know, and this is even admitted by, you know, like the New York Times and, you know, or the Guardian, you know, has written about, well, I guess, you know, maybe they weren't really beheaded in those videos. You know, maybe it happened off camera, which, of course, raises all sorts of questions about the way that these videos of these beheading. And again, we never even saw them being beheaded. You know, but instead that idea that they were beheaded. And again, that's, of course, always a more powerful thing is to have the image in someone's mind rather than actually showing it to them.
Because, well, yeah, if you can sort of walk them up to the edge of that cliff and then they have to imagine the beheading for themselves, that's what, you know, and even most people never even saw the videos. They never even got that far. They just, it was just the concept. The concept of someone being beheaded that really, you know, was rammed home to people, and they scared the crap out of them very, very temporarily, because now they don't seem to care anymore. Seem to have forgotten all about that. But I mean, the other thing about the Jim Foley, James Foley thing is that he was murdered, at least as far as we're told, he was murdered on August 19th this summer. And Homeland Season 4 began on October 5th, which is only about 6 weeks later. The episode where they refer to Jim Foley, say, you know, don't want him to end up like Jim Foley, was broadcast in mid-November. But that still doesn't leave a long time. It only leaves a matter of weeks between when this guy was killed and thus became, you know, really famous, and them having the time left to still write that into the script and record it and put it into the episodes and everything else. Unless they knew about it ahead of time, of course. That's the other possibility, is that, of course, if the CIA knew that this beheading thing was going to go down in August, then, you know, they had all the time in the world to prepare to put it into the script in Homeland. But then, of course, the other sort of reference to beheading in this series is the scene inside the vault when there is this big attack on the embassy. Lockhart and others sort of flee to this secure room, this vault, and Haqqani and his gang turn up, and they're trying to get Lockhart to come out and give them this list of names of CIA assets, because that's what they're after. And they shoot a couple of hostages. But it's only when Haqqani threatens Farah with the knife that Lockhart gives in, and he's going, you know, he's going to cut her head off, for Christ's sake. That's the thing that really motivates him to, you know, he doesn't care that two people have just been shot in the back of the head. Oh, no, the beheading. Oh, if there's a beheading. Mm-hmm. Christ, no, we can't have that. We have to respond. We have to, you know, there's a much more sort of guttural response from that. And that's very, very reminiscent of this whole, you know, ISIS beheading operation thing that happened in the summer. And it did occur to me, you know, it's just like how you just said, in these videos, we never see the beheadings. We're left to imagine them. And again, in Homeland, no one ever gets beheaded. It's simply the threat of the beheading, the concept that we're filling in our imagination, that produces that response and that, you know, we've got to do something about it. And so I just thought that was very interesting, the way they set that all up to very much reflect and once again, not necessarily mythologize those ISIS videos, but more just mythologize the guttural response that people were supposed to have to them. And to try and encourage that, and if you like, rationalize that through this, you know, brief scene in Homeland. And so, I mean, there's all sorts of things that they're doing in this. We could go on all night, to be honest, Pierce, about different things that they're doing with this. But there's a couple of last bits that I did want to focus on, and I did want to draw out for people. Because I think people will have got by now that that's what we're saying the main purpose of this season of Homeland was. But there is also, as you raised before, the question of conspiracy theories. Because even though Art Malik raises the 9/11 alternative conspiracy theory and that's sort of shut down and washed away, the whole season is quite sympathetic in some ways towards conspiracy theories. I mean, you do have that throwaway line early on where that guy who tried to sort of blow the whistle and then got relegated to the archive department, and he says, oh, now I fill freedom of information requests from conspiracy nuts in Ohio.
Yes.
And he's sort of complaining about this. But much more importantly than that, you have the Quinn character, who is a very, very sympathetic character in this season. He's kind of like, he's the guy raising the moral objections. He's the one who when Carrie starts sleeping with Ian, this young teenage naive boy who, you know, really she should be going nowhere near. he's the one who turns around to her and says, you know, you're fucking a child. That's what you're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perhaps a slight exaggeration, but it's not a massive exaggeration by any means. Mm. And he also, you know, he says things like how he didn't, that line about how he didn't want to live in a bunker killing people by remote control.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Carrie responds, that's a bit harsh. And it's like, no, it isn't.
Right, yeah.
That's exactly what you're doing. And so for us, for people like us who are watching this show, he's the guy we'd kind of identify with, really, I feel. And as we talked about, remember, in our Eyes Wide Shut discussion a couple of months back, we were talking about how, you know, the 9/11 movement and how people were sort of, a lot of people were just sort of desperately rewatching this thing over and over, looking for some kind of resolution or some kind of answer, just watching those Twin Towers get blown up time and time again, things like that. And Quinn kind of does this because he's involved in this fight in the first episode of the season where the CIA station chief gets killed. And then when he gets back to America, he's sat there on YouTube watching all the, you know, phone camera footage of this fight, trying to figure out what happens. And of course, he does figure out what happens. He spots this, you know, clip of the ISI thug in the crowd with the earpiece. And this is just like, you know, this is just like people watching Loose Change, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think I didn't even really think about that until you were just mentioning it right now. But yeah, I mean, it's exactly like that. I mean, he becomes obsessive. I mean, to the point where, I mean, he's, you know, when he's back in Washington, I mean, you know, when he's not, you know, watching all these clips, I mean, he's basically drunk off his ass all the, you know, the rest of the day. And then, you know, again, like this sort of, you know, sort of stereotypical, you know, conspiracy theorist is just sort of at home, you know, obsessively watching these videos, trying to figure out, you know, oh, maybe from this angle we could see, you know, what this. And of course, I mean, he does end up figuring out that, in fact, this whole event was staged by the ISI, you know, in order to kill Sandy and sort of get everything in motion for conceivably for Haqqani to take over the embassy and get the list. And I mean, and Quinn also engages in some other sort of things that kind of, again, you know, lend to the conspiracy culture crowd. And, you know, like you pointed out with Carrie, I mean, he has a line where he says, you know, something to the effect of just, you know, what are we even doing? Does any of this make sense? I mean, we're just killing people for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing we do is ever good. Nothing we do is ever really justified. You know, and instead it just becomes, you know, like a reflex for Quinn. To just sort of, you know, go about doing these things without any sort of notion of, well, what are the ramifications of this? How might this sort of, you know, affect something else? Not to blow back like that, but just, what are we doing? You know, how is this part of our strategy? Is this even a real strategy? And I think Quinn is the only character in this entire series that actually begins to really question, you know, what is the purpose even of the CIA? What is the purpose of this fight that we are having? Because even Saul, again, the voice of reason, at the end of the series, is basically back in the CIA, and he thinks, well, I've got to go back in now so I can fix all this stuff. Whereas Quinn, I mean, multiple times attempts to leave because he sees the reality of all of this, that it's pointless, that, you know, that he is essentially just a mercenary that goes around and kills people because some, you know, man in an office told him to. So, you know, I mean, he, again, is really the only sympathetic person. He's the only one that actually cares about, you know, anyone else other than himself. So yeah, I mean, I think we are meant to. I certainly found Quinn the only likable character, even though he does engage in some pretty extreme actions at times.
He does, but I actually found all that quite fun.
No, it's very visceral, you know, it's like a...
Well, it's quite satisfying in its own way, and mm-hmm. that's sort of why, one of the reasons why people watch these shows. But, I mean, just to spin off from that, there is... the thing that I have really sort of started to come to... that I only started to recognize in the sort of final part of this season was just how influenced this season clearly is by Sibel Edmonds' book, The Lone Gladio. Mm. And we have, of course, we've talked to Sibel quite a few times about this, both of us. Just basic things like at one point, Carrie uses the pseudonym McPherson. Well, actually, she uses it several times throughout the season, just like Greg McPherson, who is the main character in The Lone Gladio. Like you mentioned before, they kill Farah, and Farah is the character who's based on Sibel Edmonds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I interpreted this. I mean, when I when I was reviewing Sibel's book, I said that it was like a revenge fantasy, that she was sort of, you know, mm-hmm. killing the Gladio network through fiction. And I think my interpretation of why they killed Farah in the series is because it's kind of like revenge. They've killed the Sibel Edmonds character fictionally in revenge for her fictionally killing the Gladio network.
No, I think there's, yeah.
Because otherwise, why kill her off? She was actually quite an interesting character who was kind of going somewhere. But I think that must be why they did that. But just generally, like we've been talking about through this whole episode, the way they've mixed fact and fiction together, the way that this is very much addressing the real world, it's no longer just about spy fantasies and about that kind of programming. It's very, very specific. They're very much talking about the real Pakistan and the real Afghanistan and what's really happening. That's very Lone Gladio, right?
Mm.
That's what Sibel was doing. But, I mean, they're doing it for completely the opposite reason, but still.
Oh, I mean, I don't think you can... I mean... There's no way that they some people involved with this don't at least know who Sibel Edmonds is, and I find it hard to believe that they haven't read The Lone Gladio, especially when at the end, I mean, Quinn's character basically goes all rogue like Greg in The Lone Gladio, and becomes a sort of one man killing machine some of these scenes are very reminiscent of some of the scenes where Greg is sort of piecing together, getting back at everybody. And of course, he even has some woman that he's sleeping with for on and off for several years, who's a NATO official with Germany. And this woman is able to get him like C4 and all sorts of intelligence on various people. Seemingly NATO doesn't care that she's just, walking around like that. So, I mean, that again, and I'd say that's the first time that NATO has ever been mentioned in this entire series, which is interesting as well.
It pretty much never gets mentioned in spy shows.
No,
in spy fiction
not at
all. Yeah, it's all, individual agencies. It's very rarely right. the sort of overarching, whatever you'd call NATO. I mean, what the hell is NATO? But yeah, he does. He goes all rogue. He goes all Greg McPherson. And that is exactly what I wanted to have happen. And so I was quite happy when that did happen. But but you're right. You know, he has this female sidekick within NATO. And then right at the end, what happens right at the end of the season, we get the return of Dara Dahl, who is this... He's basically Gladio. He exists between agencies. He's some kind of DOD, CIA... I don't know what the hell he's supposed to be. He's this guy who he seems to turn up whenever there's some kind of crisis, basically. Mm-hmm. Whenever they're in between CIA directors, basically,
right, yeah.
He's the fill-in man. He's the deep state, basically. He's the guy who is always there when the overt, the guy at the front of the office is failing. And he turns up again, and he makes his deal with Haqqani, just like...
So many men before him.
Well, yeah, so many men before him. But just like in The Lone Gladio, and just like in reality with the real Gladio network, that's sort of where they're going with this season. It ended up, it started out in that place where, it's just about Pakistan and Afghanistan. But by the end of it, it's sort of implying so many other, this is sort of reaching into so many other things, and that it is a much more sort of international process. And I know they, as I predicted, they portrayed that, the deal that Dharadal made with Haqqani, they portrayed it as, oh, this is just some sort of short-term choice, you know, we've just got to look at what's available to us and do the logical thing. Whereas in reality, that sort of relationship is much, much longer term. It's much more about, you know, long-term geostrategy. But yeah, I just felt that's the other element to this season, is that I think they're also trying to say something to us conspiracy theorists, if you like, and say something to us fans of The Lone Gladio in particular. Because otherwise, why build in these details, I suppose?
Oh, without a doubt. And the Dharadal character is so, like, I mean, he looks like he's from another era. You know, he looks like he was around in, you know, the 70s when Gladio was sort of taking on a whole new level in Europe. And he's always wearing turtlenecks and these weird jackets. And, I mean, he just, and he seems, again, I mean, he's played by F. Murray Abraham, who, you know, can kind of play, like, any nationality, which is, I think, a great sort of, you know, he looks like he would be a real spy. You know, this guy looks like he would fit in Europe somewhere, but he could also pass as being Pakistani. He could be Iranian. He could be anything. And he definitely, I mean, it's never really mentioned what he does, what unit he's with, you know,
who he answers to.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you're totally correct in he is the deep state, at least in Homeland. He represents that nexus between, you know, the CIA and terrorism and other sort of entities and, you know, politics. And, you know, yeah, he seems to know where Quinn is off to, but he's also, you know, he's jetting off to Pakistan to meet Haqqani. He's getting Saul his job back. So yeah, and I think that they are kind of you know, putting that in there, and I think that it is definitely deliberate to fans of The Lone Gladio and to the conspiracy culture in general, and again also to kind of, you know, to throw out an element, you know, sort of hiding in plain sight. You know, yeah, these people do exist, but, you know, there's just like one guy. It's just this one bad apple, just Dharadal. You know, he seems to have no real allies within the show.
Well,
so,
what kind of name is Dharadal? Where is he supposed to be from?
No.
I mean, it's just this.
Oh, no, exactly. I mean, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
who the hell is he supposed to be, really, yeah, when it comes down to it?
Right.
And so I do think he represents that very well, this sort of menacing, almost anonymous figure that we don't really know who the hell he works for or what he's supposed to be doing, but he seems to have, you know, his fingers in everything from the DOD to the CIA to the White House to presumably foreign intelligence agencies to the Haqqani network to, you know, he is Gladio. He is exactly this thing that we've been analyzing all these years and trying to figure out. He is a symbol of that. And yeah, they've kept him bubbling away in the background. They've never made a huge amount out of his character, but he's always kind of there when they need him to be, which I think is probably a very realistic portrayal of these kind of deep state operatives. Because I think that's actually how they work. But anyway, it's getting pretty late here now, I must say. So it's probably about time we wrap this up. But my last question for you, and you may struggle to answer this, but since as we admitted at the top of the show, we are, for all our criticisms and for all we've just ripped it apart, we are still quite big fans of this show. So I suppose I was just going to ask you, what was your favourite either episode or sequence or moment or whatever from this season?
Definitely the Benghazi episode is amazing. And we talked about that was sort of our sort of like initial favourite, just because there's... it was just so well done, and there were so many great little pieces. I was also a big fan of Quinn's love affair at the beginning of the series with a slightly heavy set woman, and that was just an amazing storyline, and I really wanted that to become a whole thing, but unfortunately I guess they didn't want to go with that. I mean, I'd probably say that the whole sort of sequence of Haqqani taking over and all of that seemed to be where everything started to kind of click together for me. I will say, though, My favorite scene was when Ayan gets killed by Akane, because I found him to be the most irritating character on this entire series, and I was actually pretty glad that they got rid of him, because I didn't know where they were going with that storyline. So, yeah, I'm sorry, Ayan, but that when he got, I was pretty excited.
No, I mean, that's what I was expecting you to say, to be honest. And I can't disagree with you. It was extremely satisfying to see this character who had just sort of been ambling his way through this incredibly dangerous situation, almost blind to what he was getting into. And so it was inevitable, and it was about time that they just got rid of him and moved on. And so it was good. And I have to admit, I did quite like all the drone cam stuff. Much as I hate drones, and I hate what they represent, and I hate, you know, almost everything about them, you can't deny they do produce some very interesting video footage, and they did really make use of that in this season in a very effective way. Some of those drone cam sequences were some really good drama, I felt. But anyway, I think that's probably us done for this time, Pierce. Do you just want to quickly throw out the website and the name of the podcast?
Oh, yeah, sure. So my website is porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Porkins Policy. And the main podcast I do is Porkins Policy Radio. And I try to get that out like every week or two, but that is always difficult. And I also have a new podcast called Porkins Great Game. And I do that with Christoph Gehrman, who writes for Boiling Frogs Post. And anyone that's interested in some of the, you know, the things that we've been talking about here and some of the sort of bigger picture with terrorism, and especially with the whole Gladio network and everything, would definitely like that show, because me and Christoph deal exclusively with Central Asia and the Caucasus and the war on terror and all the sort of geostrategic things that are going on there. And Tom, I just want to say thanks again for having me on the show. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And, you know, I let's talk about Homeland again sometime soon, because there's still a lot more that we could get into.
Well, sure, Pierce. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I think we've got into some great areas here. You're right. We could carry on talking about this season. Maybe we will. Maybe we will do a follow-up. but I think for this time, we should wrap it up there. So thanks, man. It's been great fun.
Thank you, Tom.
So once more, that was Pierce Redmond of Porkins Policy Radio. And that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. We were both rather tired when we were recording it, and for me it was coming up to midnight by the time we finished. But we did cover a lot of good ground, and so I hope you got a lot out of it. So I'll wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and say that I hope you continue to join me on Clandestime in the New Year. As always, I am your host, Tom Secker of SpyCulture.com, so thank you for listening, and take care.